Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hi, this is Mike Behe. I've been a senior fellow with Discovery Institute for over 20 years. When the Darwinian establishment was enraged by my book, Darwin's Black Box, the Discovery Institute was there for me through thick and thin, and has been over the years for my intelligent design colleagues as well. It is your financial support of ID the Future and the Discovery Institute that makes all of that possible. Please consider giving a donation today to support scholars of intelligent design. Go to discovery.org/csc/2020 to give. That's discovery.org/csc/2020. Thanks.
Welcome. I'm your guest host today, Mike Keyes. I had a conversation with another Mike Flannery, and we're continuing that now with relating the article that he published at evolutionnews.org called Darwinism, Past, Present, and Future, relating that to his work on the co-founder of evolutionary ideas, Alfred Russel Wallace. That is a guy who lived at the time of Darwin who stumbled on the kernel of the idea of evolution by means of natural selection and then later had some doubts about where Darwin took that. First of all, I want to welcome again Mike Flannery back to the show. Thanks, Mike, for joining us.
I'm glad to be here, and thanks for taking time out to do this, Mike.
So your book with University of Alabama Press, which is where you continue to be a professor emeritus.
That's University of Alabama Press, which is sort of the flagship of the University of Alabama system. I'm actually at the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
Got it.
Separate institution, but same board and same chance.
Where's the press located at?
The press is located in Tuscaloosa, which is about 50 miles from where I'm speaking now.
Okay. So anyway, you have this book with University of Alabama Press called Nature's Prophet, Alfred Russel Wallace and His Evolution from Natural Selection to Natural Theology. And in our last conversation, we were talking about Darwinism and its history up to the present moment. Now, Wallace has his own kind of history. That is, the early Wallace, who co-discovered natural selection, later had doubts about where Darwin eventually took his theory. So tell us about what we can learn about Darwinism, past, present, and future by thinking about this co-founder, Alfred Russel Wallace.
Right. Well, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to really trace out in some detail, in a sense, Wallace's own evolution from his independent discovery of the theory of natural selection while he was on the island of Ternate in the Malay Archipelago. And then his movement toward what really wound up being a natural theology. He winds up breaking with Charles Darwin in 1869. Over the special attributes of human beings. He says you cannot attribute that to natural forces and certainly to the power of natural selection because human beings have too many attributes that are unique and special to them and not shared by the animal kingdom. And the only way we can account for these special attributes, for example, art, music, the ability to think abstractly, these specifically human attributes have to be derived from some other source. And he called upon an overruling intelligence to do that. And of course, Darwin was aghast, and all of Darwin's entourage was equally aghast. And he became a heretic, as one biographer calls him, a heretic in Darwin's court. And continued to be that up through the end of his life, which occurred in 1913.
Now, in our last conversation, we referred to Jean Guyon's advocacy of so-called universal Darwinism, which sounds like if you apply scientific naturalism to natural history, you should also apply it to the realm of humanity, and try to explain everything from why people rape to why people take care of their babies and everything in between. So you write about how Wallace was, I guess you could call him an opponent of scientism, but of course it wasn't known as scientism in his day. What was the sort of the equivalent term of scientism that Wallace was challenging in his time?
Well, I guess you might call it materialism.
Mm-hmm.
And really what it was a sort of positivism, which had been founded by Auguste Comte,
mm-hmm.
the French writer. And those were the ideas that he was opposing, this reductionism to only material forces and only material causes. And that was something that was really going against the grain of Victorian science at the time, which was quickly heading down the road of what we know today as scientism. It was being spearheaded. Darwin's ideas were taken and really being spearheaded by people like Thomas Henry Huxley to really sort of permeate what counts as science and what doesn't. And Wallace always opposed that sort of reductionist approach and wrote really a grand book about it. And his grand statement in opposition to this was a book that he published in 1910 called The World of Life, which even people today who are regarded as so-called Wallace scholars don't like to talk about. And I spend a good deal of time talking about it in my book.
Speaking of contemporary historians of science who study Wallace in relation to Darwin, there have been two of these fellows who have recently reviewed your book. And in preparing for our conversation, I've read those reviews. So let's talk about them. Let's start with the one that's favorable. This one's by a historian of science by the name of Patrick Armstrong at the University of Western Australia. And it's published in a very good journal called Metascience, which deals in history and philosophy of science.
Yes.
So tell us about Armstrong's review of your book. And in doing so, you're kind of giving us a thumbnail of some of the main points of your book. Like, how does Armstrong agree with you, basically?
I was delighted to read it because it was clear to me from beginning to end that Armstrong got the point of the book.
Mm-hmm.
He understood why I wrote it, and he understands the contribution that it makes to the Wallace historiography. He admits it's not an easy read because I'm dealing with more or less the history of ideas and some difficult concepts to unpack, but I think he understands it to be important reading.
Right.
And he certainly appreciated the research that I did, and I was just delighted to get that favorable review from Professor Armstrong, whom I really didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And come to find out that he has done a fair amount of work on Darwin himself and has recently published a short biography of Alfred Russel Wallace that is quite good, actually.
Yeah, I noticed his work has a lot to do with geographical studies and the history of ideas in geographical studies, which is right up your alley, since that's what what Wallace concentrated on, is the biogeographical distribution of species and how that relates to natural history.
Right.
So, yeah, I think so. Patrick Armstrong was well qualified to review your book, and of course, he published it in one of the leading journals in the field of history and philosophy of science. Now, this other essay review of your book is a shorter review. It's by Andrew Berry at Harvard in the Journal of British Studies,
mm-hmm.
Which is not particularly about history and philosophy of science, but nevertheless, it's an appropriate journal to also review your book in. So
sure.
Now I will just say I did a little background checking on Andrew Berry. When I think of him at being at Harvard, I'm reminded of Stephen Jay Gould, who similarly at Harvard worked as a practicing scientist, but also did history of science. And so it looks like Berry has a similar reach of his professional career has been like Gould, of course, not to the stature of Gould, but still at Harvard. So tell us about Andrew Berry's review of your book.
Well, I guess as I have said in my own reply, which I rebutted his review largely in Evolution News, which your listeners can get to and look up, I said why Nature's Prophet had to be written. And if anybody embodies that, it's Andrew Berry. He clearly missed the point. He was, pot-shotting for things to criticize to begin with, which you know, I kind of expected that because I know that much of what I say in the book is controversial, and so that doesn't surprise me. It also doesn't surprise me that Barry went gunning for it because he is, after all, an evolutionary biologist who appears, as far as I can tell, rather regularly at the Darwin Day celebrations and all the rest. So, you know, his response was somewhat predictable.
Sure, but, sure. Because he's very interested in the future of Darwinism, isn't he? Like, that it goes well. So that might color his interpretation of its history, I suppose.
Right. Now, what astonished me the most about his review is he actually makes this claim that there is nothing remotely Christian about Wallace's teleology. Hmm. Now, you know, when we say teleology, we're talking about purpose. And this to me was astonishing because it told me, A, he didn't know anything about Wallace, and B, he apparently doesn't know much about church history.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just, if I could boil it down and say why this is such a fundamentally false statement. Now, I'm not claiming that Wallace was a Christian. Wallace never claimed to be a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
But his theory of teleology in nature, which he exposits at length in The World of Life, is actually quite compatible with Christianity, without himself being a Christian. So it's possible to do both. And one reason I can give for that is John Magan Mello, who was an Anglican vicar, immediately recognized the theological implications of Wallace's World of Life, and he wrote an extensive essay in its defense. And then Mello was quite taken with Wallace's assertion that God didn't create the physical world and the cosmos directly, but through the delegated authority of intermediaries. Now, what these intermediaries were, Wallace doesn't specifically say. He says you can call them gods, you can call them angels, you can call them what you will, but they are intermediaries who are working and guiding natural properties. So, in fact, Mello wrote, our Lord himself speaks to us in no uncertain terms of the ministry of angels and of the interest they take in human life. Both in the Old and New Testament and in the New, we are told how God has made and still makes use of angels in connection with the control of physical forces. And this is exactly what Wallace is talking about in The World of Life. So Mello got it. Not only that, Thomas Aquinas in his Summa Theologica, that goes back to, what, about 1260, 1265, somewhere around in there, wrote that God governs many things through his angels and permits through his generosity and good graces a sharing of his creative work. And again, the 5th century Christian Pseudo-Dionysius, the Areopagite, presented the same idea. So, you know, whether Wallace knew it or not, his delegated intermediary creation, which is laid out in The World of Life, is really speaking to a form of Christian orthodoxy that was established centuries ago. The fact that Barry doesn't recognize this, I think, is quite astonishing, that he obviously doesn't know what Wallace was writing about in The World of Life. And he also doesn't know much about church history. So you kind of throw your hands up and go, this is the guy who's trying to review a book
right. That
is talking about Wallace and his, shall we say, his direction or his walk toward natural theology. I can't think of a person who could be more poorly equipped to handle that topic than Andrew Barry.
Well, maybe Andrew Barry can educate himself about church history by reading your book more thoroughly and your response to his review in evolutionnews.org, where you show the shortcomings. So all we can do is hope the best for him, but for our listeners, we can hope for even more, since they're likely to actually go read your book and look at your essays at evolutionnews.org. So thank you so much, Mike, for explaining what's been happening. And as other scholars have interacted with your wonderful book, Nature's Prophet, Alfred Russel Wallace and His Evolution from Natural Selection to Natural Theology, published just last year And yeah, it's good to see that your book has stimulated some interesting conversations. And
yes,
it does connect with conversations about the past, present, and future of Darwinism, which is of great interest to our listeners. So thank you for bringing this to us in an accessible way, Mike.
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to the audience today.
All right. Well, you have been listening to ID the Future. I am Mike Keyes. Thanks for joining us.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.